This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the real-life hero of the movie Hotel Rwanda denounces the country's dictator, Paul Kagame. A prediction that the United States can never militarily defeat the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And new efforts to restrict the use of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. But first, five African nations have formed an uneasy alliance to battle the Islamic jihadists of Boko Haram. Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Benin have joined Nigeria to battle Boko Haram under the direction of the United States, France, and Great Britain. Eric Dreitzer is a political analyst in New York City and publisher of the website StopImperialism.com. Dreitzer says Nigeria claims they've got Boko Haram on the run.
Well, it depends on what we mean by believed. I mean, certainly we're going to see some kind of operation. We're going to see some sort of a superficial attempt at reining in this threat, which is now becoming a regional threat. But I think the larger question, the question that really should be central in our thinking, is the role that these regional governments have played in creating this situation in the first place. Because I don't think that it's a secret, either in Nigeria or around West Africa, that countries like Chad and Cameroon and Niger have all benefited from Boko Haram. We have reports of 3D oil drilling taking place in each of these countries where they are quite literally stealing oil from under the feet of Nigerian people. We also know that Boko Haram and certain other extremist elements have had safe haven inside of Chad, and we know of documented evidence of connections between powerful people both within Nigeria and some of the surrounding countries that are affiliated in direct or indirect ways with Boko Haram. And so it's sort of farcical and really sort of par for the imperial course, if you will, that the countries that are very central in fostering and facilitating the growth of Boko Haram and benefiting from it are now parading themselves as if they're going to be addressing this problem. Now, at the larger level, of course, none of these countries operate independently. They are all in various capacities proxies of former colonial masters, such as the French, the British to some extent, the United States as well. And of course, all of these international actors really stand above and behind this entire issue. And that's really, I think, how it needs to be understood.
And yet Chad, an intervention and incursion into Nigerian territory, is credited with one of the first military setbacks for Boko Haram, causing great embarrassment, it seems, to the Nigerian armed forces.
Well, and that shouldn't come as any surprise because, of course, there is a sort of a regional rivalry that's developing here. And look, we have seen since the fall of Gaddafi and the destruction of Libya and the imperial war in 2011, that Chad, under the government of Idris Deby, has really become more of an assertive player regionally, and not only asserting themselves in terms of oil resources and making deals internationally, but also asserting themselves militarily. And I think that it's important to recall that Chad was one of the major transit points for the weapons that came streaming out of Libya after the fall of Gaddafi's government, and that Chad had, in many ways, longstanding ties to militants in the region, as well as to certain regional governments as well. And so I don't think that it's really necessarily a surprise that Chad would be involved militarily in this way, but it sort of, again, begs the question, to what extent is this really a disingenuous mission that they're engaging in? On the one hand, promoting, facilitating, and profiting from Boko Haram, and then on the other hand, presenting themselves as if they're the opposition. So in many ways, there's a political game that's being played that is really to the detriment of the government of Nigeria, of course. There's also a larger geopolitical and strategic game that they're playing, and I think that Chad sees in itself the possibility of becoming more or less a regional hegemon, although to what extent that's even possible in the region of West Africa is really sort of an open question.
Yes, the question becomes, who is hegemonizing whom? Since Chad is widely seen as a client state of both the French and the Americans.
Well, that's exactly right. And so, again, I think that the way to understand what Chad really is that they are a proxy. They are a stand-in for the colonial powers that stand behind them. And I think that Deby really, in many ways, is placing himself in a long tradition of African leaders, post-colonial African leaders, who really have no independent policy, who really don't represent anything other than plunder and exploitation of the resources, both human and natural, of their own countries, in the service of European and North American colonial powers.
Internally, Nigeria appears to be, at least politically, destabilized, with internal opponents seeming to charge President Goodluck Jonathan with either being too soft on the Boko Haram rebellion or even being in cahoots with it, and Goodluck Jonathan's supporters making similar charges to the opposition.
Yeah, and really what you see there is a fracturing of the Nigerian body politic, if you will, and I think that there is a very specific reason why that's happening. Nigeria is understood internationally as by far the most dynamic economy in all of Africa. It is a major prize for the United States and for the European powers, and increasingly one that has had its eyes on China, has had very important business dealings with the Chinese in recent years. We also know that the Nigerians are not exactly keen on the idea of continuing to allow Western oil companies to exploit their resources at the rates that they've been doing that. And so in some ways, we could see that Boko Haram and this regional conflict that has really kind of split Nigerian politics is really part and parcel of a larger strategy of breaking whatever independent policy Nigeria was going to pursue. And this is not to say that President Jonathan is somehow, you know, someone that should be held up as the model of a leader for the 21st century. But at the same time, Jonathan is no devil. Jonathan is not, you know, even necessarily the worst leader in the region, let alone in his own country. And so, again, I think the question becomes, whose agenda is it to destroy the government? Whose agenda is it to divide Nigeria? Are we looking at the beginnings of a possible Balkanization, a possible breakup of the Nigerian state? This is a very real possibility, and one that I don't think was necessarily realistic or likely even a year ago or 2 years ago, but certainly more so today. And the question becomes, along what lines would the country split? Naturally, there's a north-south divide, religious divide, and a cultural divide, but there are also ethnic groups within Nigeria, and anyone who knows recent Nigerian history understands this, that these ethnic groups, particularly such as like the Yoruba, for example, who have their own agenda in many ways and who might also benefit from something like this. And so a breakup of Nigeria, entirely possible. Boko Haram could be the transitional phase towards that.
And could there be some jockeying between the imperial powers as well, Nigeria being such a prize of the five regional powers that supposedly are collaborating militarily against Boko Haram? Four of them are former French colonies. I remember about a year ago when there was the first large kidnapping of Nigerian girls by Boko Haram. All five countries were summoned to Paris and ordered to get their military act together and suppress Boko Haram. That was a year ago. Is the United States more deeply involved now?
Absolutely. Taking that one piece at a time, the French are really deeply involved in all of these countries. And I think it should be remembered that the French don't really have a decolonial mindset at all. In many ways, their mindset is very neo-colonial. They see the Francophone countries of Africa as still being part and parcel of France in whatever capacity that might be. And you can look at it from a corporate perspective. A company such as Areva, which is one of the major mining companies in the region, they really are central to the entire policy of a country like Niger, whose president is a former employee of that French conglomerate. And so you see that there are direct corporate links between the French and these countries. There are also deep military cooperation. so-called cooperation between France and these regional players. And so the French kind of see themselves not simply as mediators and not simply as organizers, but they do really see these as their colonial children, lost children, if you will, that they would like to bring back into the fold in whatever capacity that they can. And then from the U.S. perspective, of course, the U.S. being the global imperial power that it is, the United States has really established an entire military architecture throughout all of Africa. And it's not simply the abstraction of AFRICOM. We have a wide network of small military installations, be they drone bases, such as the ones in Niger, be they surveillance outposts, such as the ones in Burkina Faso, be they whatever the small forward operating facilities that they now have in various countries in West Africa. These are all part of a larger military architecture that the United States has developed, an infrastructure for the exertion of their power, for projecting U.S. power throughout the African continent in a way without having to have, quote unquote, boots on the ground. We all remember what happened when the United States wanted to establish AFRICOM bases in Africa, and they were rebuffed almost everywhere. And so that actual rebuffing of the United States transformed their agenda from a direct military footprint into a much lighter footprint, the kind that they've developed over the course of the last few years, and almost nobody is talking about it.
The United States was, at least a year ago, actively training a brigade of Nigerian special operations troops, but we haven't seen them actively engaged against Boko Haram.
That's right. And again, the United States, part of what they do is not simply the so-called training. It is embedding U.S. military officers, embedding intelligence officers within the military bureaucracies of whichever country they are implanting themselves in. And this is really true across the entire continent. And so, sure, the United States will provide training. They might provide equipment. They might provide logistical support in whatever capacities they can, surveillance and intelligence and all of these things. But these are all a means to an end. They are not in and of themselves the end. The end is really for the U.S. to maintain operational control over the military structures of each of these countries without having to do that in an overt sort of way. And so I think in many ways we could see this as a transformation of U.S. imperialism in Africa that is moving away from direct military intervention, such as you saw in Libya, for example, and moving towards, I guess, what we could call more of a soft intervention or a silent intervention, one that is so far under the radar that most people have no clue that it's even happening.
The Boko Haram crisis has forced the postponement of elections in Nigeria.
Right. And again, the reasoning for that, I think, is probably sound, at least domestically. There is an insurgency that's going on. I mean, you have mass killings on a broad scale that is really very difficult to even grasp for those of us in the West. But the question becomes not so much the delay, the postponement of these elections, but what do these elections really mean? Who is exactly running and on what platform? Because at this point, the election has been entirely transformed into a referendum on Jonathan's handling of the Boko Haram threat. And so when you start to think about what exactly is going to change after this election, it doesn't seem like very much other than the fact that there might be some kind of a more, let's call it, militarized crackdown if Buhari, the candidate that is being put up by the APC, the All Progressives Congress, if he were to win. Because again, this is not on program. This is not on economics. This is not on social issues. This is entirely about who is going to crush Boko Haram more effectively. And I think that tells us all we need to know about how Nigerian politics has been transformed by this Boko Haram threat, which I would add is entirely manufactured.
Boko Haram emerged in its current form in 2010 after a military crackdown by the Nigerian armed forces, which resulted in the public execution of Boko Haram's founder and the death of hundreds of its followers in the largest city in that region.
That's right. But I think it's important to also trace the roots back even further, because there were these militias, these networks that were financed by various political figures and financiers inside of Nigeria. And they were used for, you know, basic thuggery in previous elections. But when that well of money dried up, those networks transformed into what we know of Boko Haram today, both transforming themselves ideologically, aligning themselves with this, with a more extremist ideology, and also transforming the very nature of what it is that they were doing. They became less of political muscle and more into a fighting force. And that transformation has very real roots in this move to promulgate Boko Haram as a regional threat. And so again, I think that when we think about Boko Haram, we need to think not only about how it transforms from a loose collection of political muscle and thugs into an actual fighting force, and then we need to ask the broader question of why and in whose interests.
Political analyst Eric Dreitzer speaking from New York. Paul Rusesa Bagina is the real-life hero of the movie Hotel Rwanda. American actor John Cheadle portrayed Rusesa Bagina's efforts to save fellow Rwandans during the violence of 1994, when Paul Kagame's forces overthrew the majority Hutu government and seized power. In the movie, Kagame's forces are portrayed as the good guys. But in real life, Kagame's government is a dictatorship of members of the minority Tutsi tribe. Paul Rusesa Bagina now lives in exile and has written a book titled An Ordinary Man. He appeared on Phil Taylor's show at radio station CIUT in Toronto, Canada. He talked about Paul Kagame's attempts to change Rwandan law so that he can remain in office.
Since Kagame took over in 1994, I was in the country, and I'm one of the eyewitnesses, one of those people who saw what was happening, how RPF, the Kagame's army, was tying people from the back, beating their chests, breaking them, and then throwing those tired people, putting them into containers, and they're dying there. So they were taking those dead bodies, going to burn them, and throwing their ashes into the national park. We saw many politicians being assassinated, trying to go into their home around 6 in the evening, when which was not too late, 6-7. We saw many people being put into prisons in hundreds of thousands. The Kagame government has done a lot of disasters. So I wouldn't be surprised to see someone who has completely stopped any political space allowed, in a pure, simple dictatorship. There is no human rights, there are human rights abuses everywhere, all over the country. So there is no freedom of media. There is no freedom of association. So this man, I can't see him leaving, because he has also, as everybody, the whole world knows, he has followed the refugees into the Congo, has massacred Rwandan Hutu refugees within the Congo forest between 1996 and 2003. Do you see such a man who is accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and even crimes of genocide, according to the UN mapping report? Do you see him leaving power? He survives because he is hanging on that small rope, which is called power. The very day he leaves the power, we know that the French judge has been indicted him. So the French justice will be also looking forward to getting Mr. Kagame also in court. We know that the Spanish judges also have indicted him. Well, the very day he's no more covered by his presidential immunity, Mr. Kagame will be finding himself in Spain. The International Criminal Court also has not indicted him because he's still protected by his presidential immunity. How can we imagine such a man leaving power? Mm-hmm. I don't see him leaving power in a peaceful manner.
This point about the refugees, and you, of course, experienced this in your own family, yourself, and we know there is a diaspora of people who have escaped the grasp of this regime and are exercising their right as refugees or attempting to, but they're always under an onus, aren't they? It's difficult for Rwandan refugees, wherever they are in the world, they are treated, first of all, like suspects, and then second, as refugees. Isn't that right?
Well, Rwandan refugees, Phil, have never been understood. They have never been understood, even today. When I hear the United States of America, the United Nations, the United Kingdom, saying that those refugees should go home, it is not further than later than before yesterday night that one of the most prominent businessmen, a tycoon of Kigali, or the capital city, was assassinated with many other guys. They put his dead body into a Mercedes. And then with the people who were killed with him, they took a DMI, a Directorate of Military Intelligence truck, and it happened to hit his car, and they pretended that it was a Nazi dent. So, now we are taking people, refugees from camps, knowing purposely that we are taking them to a lion or a leopard, which is going to eat them, to kill them immediately. We have seen a lot of dead bodies floating into the Kagera River, crossing. We saw them floating into Lake Ruweru towards Burundi and the Tanzanian side of the Kagera. So now, we are purposely sending people in such an atmosphere of massacres. So once again, the United Nations are failing because they don't want to sit down and solve the conflict. The conflict is never solved by force, because in Rwanda we have tried to solve our conflict by guns for the last 50 and more years. We have never succeeded. So I believe that today, the best way to solve the Rwandan conflict is to bring the whole truth of all of those things that have been taking place, massacres, bring them to the table, talk about them openly. Kagame has been responsible. He should also be answerable to justice.
That was exiled Rwandan Paul Rusesa Begina. Jennifer Lowenstein teaches Middle Eastern studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. She recently wrote an article for Counterpunch magazine titled Burnt Offering. Lowenstein says Americans should denounce ISIS, the Islamic State, as a Frankenstein's monster that the United States helped to create, and they should understand that terrorism is the result of U.S. policy in the region. In general, said Lowenstein, Americans are not only ignorant about their own country's policies, they are willfully ignorant.
I believe that American ignorance plays an enormous role and a dangerous role. But I want to clarify that American ignorance, as deep as it runs, is twofold. Primarily, it is a result of a government and a state apparatus that imposes our knowledge from the top down into places like the media and the public schools, so that many people who are ignorant are unaware of how ignorant or misguided they are. I'm saying that I hold the United States government primarily responsible for sustaining American ignorance and for spreading it and for misleading and lying to the American public. At the same time, having been a teacher for some 30 years, I think that American ignorance, or popular ignorance, has another side to it, which I find frightening as well. And that is that many people, many students, people who are mostly privileged, not only are they ignorant, many of them know that they're ignorant. What is more troubling to me is that they don't care that they're ignorant. There isn't a built-in curiosity to find out and to examine what they've been told, to question it. I don't know why that is the case, but I find it a frightening phenomenon. And when you couple it with that our knowledge or lack thereof is imposed from the regime downwards, I think there is a really frightening blend of ignorance, of types of ignorance, that will ultimately lead this country into a pariah role in the world. We will become and are becoming a pariah nation, despised by almost every other country in the world.
This U.S. government, which pretends it has nothing to do and has never had anything to do with the Islamic State, actually has been involved, along with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and others, with creating the jihadist network in the late 70s in Afghanistan.
Oh, I think it goes way beyond the late 70s. I think the history of Western colonialism in the Middle East, primarily British and French, which was then supplanted by U.S. imperialism after the Second World War. I think that the roots of the current Middle East go very, very deep. What we see today in the Middle East is the product not of three or four decades of misguided American policy. It is a product of at least two and a half centuries of European and Western American intrusion into the Middle East, and intrusion, imposition of values, standards, ideologies, racist mindsets, some of the worst phenomena to come out of the Middle East in the last century have their roots in the colonial past of Europe and the United States. People are going to be forced to choose sides. Sunni Muslims who don't like what ISIS is doing are going to be better off silently or tacitly supporting them than they will be if they embrace the West, the United States, and its tactics, because we are not going to win. The United States and its allies are not going to defeat ISIS militarily. And that's what it's come down to. If I were a Sunni Muslim living in Iraq today, I would be very afraid for my family and for my, obviously, for my children and for the future of my land. I don't want ISIS anywhere near me. I also want the United States and its puppet government to get the hell out of there. I would want to be left alone and be allowed to live my life and raise my children the way I deem appropriate without having to fear sectarian warfare or a global war between a Western-backed coalition and extremists funded by a variety of different groups on the ground. I think that's very difficult, and I think it's very complicated for a lot of people to understand.
And so the more the United States tries to penetrate and dominate the region, the greater the pull or lure of an organization like the Islamic State, despite its ghastly violence.
I don't know that it will convince many people to join it in the sense of adopting or embracing its ideology. It will certainly not convince people that its tactics are acceptable. I know that people are appalled by what it is doing, but since these are the people living there, since people living there are the ones who have to face this every day, it is going to be wiser for them to be quiet and openly, if they speak openly, oppose Western power and Western proxies. That's the safest route they can take, unless they want to put their lives on the line and openly oppose what ISIS is doing, as well as what the United States is doing. It's a terrible situation because it's unwinnable in the way that it is currently being fought is unwinnable. The United States is not going to destroy ISIS militarily. What they are going to succeed at is intensifying the fight, is causing groups similar to ISIS to align themselves with it, to become a second front, even when there is a lot of infighting, people going over to join the fight with ISIS for whatever warped reasons they may have, anger, who knows. These people are going there with the thought that they are fighting Shia Muslims and apostates or people who are not truly Muslim. And what they find is that within ISIS and its allied organizations, they're fighting each other. There's all of this internecine fighting. Nevertheless, the more the United States and the coalition partners bomb and attack ISIS militarily, the more likely it is that ISIS and its like-minded organizations are going to have a united front, that they are going to be seen as, quote-unquote, the other side. Then, into the mix of the U.S. and its coalition partners, and on the other side, ISIS and groups aligned with it in one way or another, we have to add the very big part that is being played by Iran, the Shia people and powers in Iraq, the Syrian leadership. Bashar al-Assad is Alawite, a Shia sect, and Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is a Lebanese Shiite political party and resistance organization. So you have a fault line between the U.S. Western coalition and its allies, ISIS and its extremist allies and organizations fighting each other, and the third party, which includes the Shiite powers, Iran most prominently, Iraq in a way that's difficult to explain since the government is backed by the West, but the majority of Iraqis are Shiites, Syria, the Syrian government, and Hezbollah under Hassan Nasrallah. So ISIS is supposedly targeting the Shiites primarily, Shiites and non-Muslims. These same people are traditionally U.S. adversaries. The United States has been railing on about Hezbollah and Iran for a long time now. So if there are ironies that we can see in this, and there are many, one of them is that our traditional adversaries, Iran, Hezbollah, Bashar al-Assad's regime, these in particular are the same enemies that ISIS is fighting. And that makes it, for people on the outside, not only is that confusing, it's also really quite perverse. It's in the interest of the United States to work with Iran, to work with Hezbollah, to come to some kind of negotiated agreement with Bashar al-Assad and his regime, and to come to an understanding with the majority Shia population of Iraq, so that the Shiite population of the Middle East is not caught between a U.S. coalition of mostly Sunni Arab powers, Western powers, and itself, and on the other side, ISIS. Does that make sense? I mean, there are three parties here we're talking about.
You've described it, and you've also, in describing it, shown that there is no scenario that looks good for U.S. imperial ambitions in the region.
None. There are none. There are some really very positive potential steps that the United States could take or could allow, but in the name of security, which means nothing other than state security, security for our own perceived national interests, these other potential solutions are not going to be allowed anytime soon.
Jennifer Lowenstein teaches Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Jean Ross is a lawyer and a member of the People's Organization for Progress, based in Newark, New Jersey. Ross recently testified before a committee of the New Jersey State Legislature on a bill that would limit the use of solitary confinement in prison.
Well, first, let me say that the bill covers both prisons and jails in New Jersey, so that's an important point. And the bill would limit the use of solitary confinement for all prisoners, but would bar the use of solitary confinement for certain vulnerable populations, including notably people under 21, elderly people, people with mental illness or developmental disabilities, people with severe medical problems or severe hearing or vision problems, and pregnant women. And the reason that we chose those categories is that those are categories that are being protected in other legislation, either proposed federal legislation or in legislation in other states. And I want to say that we are part of a movement in this country to limit the use of solitary confinement, which is supported by a number of eminent officials and professional organizations in a commission report confronting confinement as far back as 2006, the American Bar Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI, and many other organizations have all come out in support of limiting long-term solitary confinement and also barring its use for vulnerable populations. The UN rapporteur, Juan Mendez, wrote a report in 2011, I believe it was, saying that the isolation in solitary confinement of people with mental illness and minors was tantamount to torture, and that to keep any human being in solitary confinement for more than 15 days also pretty much amounts to torture as well. So we have not invented something that just out of whole cloth. We're listening to what people are saying in other states, and we're listening to professionals and human rights advocates.
Identifying some of those vulnerable groups that should not be placed in solitary confinement is easy if they're identified by age or pregnancy, but how do you identify people who are mentally ill? Who says they're mentally ill?
Well, in our particular formulation, we're saying that anyone who has a history of psychiatric hospitalization should be considered vulnerable. And like it or not, there are psychiatrists and doctors and psychologists in the prisons, and they regularly screen people and evaluate people, although they don't do very much treatment. And we have to rely on their judgments. They're already making those judgments, but we want to make sure that their judgments are monitored and reviewed on a regular basis. So we're actually asking that because solitary confinement is so bad for any human being, because it, in a sense, instigates severe mental illness for people who are at risk of developing acute symptoms, as well as exacerbating the illness of people who have already been identified as having a mental illness. Because it's so dangerous and because the symptoms that are experienced by people in solitary confinement are so distressing and so persistent, that's why we basically say that they suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, just like veterans do, just like victims of domestic violence. We require in the bill that anyone in solitary confinement be reviewed every single day by a clinician, and we define what we mean, which kinds of clinicians we're talking about.
Well, you say in your own testimony that initial clinical screenings for mental illness for people who are about to be sent into solitary confinement, these screenings are often cursory. And yet you also testify to the fact that state law in New Jersey places strict restrictions on solitary confinement in state psychiatric hospitals. So it appears here that the current situation is that it's easier to be placed in solitary confinement if you have a mental problem in a New Jersey state prison than it is if you're in a psychiatric care hospital.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That particular difficulty is not going to be solved by this bill. What we need in New Jersey and every state is an effective, independent monitoring system for the prisons, which we really don't have now in New Jersey. And that's a separate project which myself and many of my allies are working on, but this bill has come up before we have such a mechanism in place. We need to have independent, community-based monitoring of our prisons.
Who's lobbying for continued solitary confinement of prisoners? Is it the guards?
No, actually, we met with people representative of the guards unions, and they understand that people with mental illness need to be treated differently. They are the people on the ground who are faced with dealing with folks who have a mental illness and are not receiving proper treatment from clinicians. So they would like to have better alternatives, but they have not been able to get support from the Department of Corrections. We think that those people are very much our allies, because if we can limit the use of solitary confinement, then we will probably have the same experience as Maine and Mississippi, which is that with reduced solitary confinement, violence in the prisons goes down, community safety is improved when people are released, and recidivism will be reduced as well. So the guards want safer prisons. We want safer prisons for both people in prison and also for the guards and other civilians who work in the prisons. Those are state workers and county workers, and we're concerned about the welfare of working people in these very difficult institutions.
Yes, you've said that states like Mississippi and their penal systems are more advanced and enlightened in terms of how to treat mentally ill people than the state of New Jersey.
That's right, and Senator Lesniak said somewhat informally at a meeting yesterday that if Mississippi could do it, New Jersey should be able to do it. But the way that these states like Mississippi and Maine have gotten safer prisons and more humane prisons is by encouraging the state correctional agency in both of those cases was instrumental in bringing together stakeholders, which include human rights advocates, community people, advocates for people with mental illness, as well as the correction officers and their union representatives, and problem solving together.
Attorney Gene Ross of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey. Bryant Arroyo is an inmate at Freckville State Prison in Pennsylvania, the same facility where Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, also resides. Mr. Arroyo produced this report for Prison Radio.
The State Correctional Institution at Freckville is a small facility located in the Pennsylvania Pocono Mountain region. Opened in 1987, this facility originally housed problematic prisoners. Currently, SCI Freckville houses about 1,140 prisoners and is a classified security level 4 facility, the highest general population security level. SCI Freckville is known as a crap hole. in the prisoner community, perhaps the worst state facility. This reputation is warranted by the extremely poor conditions, coupled with the guards' overly negative attitude. Indeed, serving time at Frackville is a depressing, miserable experience. Daily operations entail severely restricted prisoner movement and manic adherence to daily routines. Many SCI Frackville prisoners are confined to their cells up to 20 hours each day. Confinement conditions that approach the 22-hour daily confinement conditions in the hole. The arrogant, hostile attitudes on the part of the guards contribute to the harsh, oppressive environment. The guards seem to find great pride, even honor, in perpetuating their anti-prisoner culture, thus creating a fiefdom of arbitrary, unrestrained authority separate from the state correctional system. Even state correctional officials know SCI Frackville is a crap hole. It is frequently utilized as a last stop destination for disfavored prisoners like jailhouse lawyers, writers, and activists. Transfers to SCI Frackville are generally considered demotional or punitive in nature. Certainly no Pennsylvania state prisoner wants to serve time here, including myself, see our moves as a punitive action. In early 2014, the Pennsylvania correctional system designated certain facilities for regional mental health treatment units. Consequently, hundreds of prisoners were transferred among the various facilities as those with psychiatric problems were placed in one of the regional units. The state correctional institution at SCI Mahanoy was a facility designated mental health unit, and quite naturally, the administrators there took advantage of the situation to remove quote-unquote troublemaker prisoners from its population. As a result, I was among the 100 prisoners to be transferred from SCI Mahanoy to SCI Frackville in April and May of 2014. The records of those transferred with me confirmed that most of us were writers, jailhouse lawyers, and advocates. Nevertheless, the administrators still insist that our transfers were not demotional or punitive in nature. Many of us, upon our arrival at SCI Frackville, began experiencing problems from the moment of our intake. Personal property items were damaged or arbitrarily confiscated without the standard procedural protections. Property room sergeant, Sergeant Craniac, is ultimately responsible for his corner of this fiefdom. He knows his actions are essentially unreviewed by any higher authority. Many transferring prisoners' property items were simply lost, damaged, or confiscated in accordance with local practice and in disregard from the DOC regulations. Prisoner Jose Salinas, EV 9035, stated, "These rogue officers run with impunity, accountable to no one. Any prisoner who dares to file grievances will end up threatened, harassed, intimidated, and or physically harmed any way they can manage to get away with. On many occasions, Jose has filed grievances and somehow they strangely disappeared without a trace and literally have exhausted myself to refile the same grievances multiple times prior to obtaining an official number indicating the grievances were received and processed. Many prisoners' family members have been sexually harassed and discriminated against by officers in the visiting lobby where visitors are processed. The officers utilize metal detectors and run them over the female breast area as a pretext to find out whether or not the female visitors are wearing a brassiere with a metal wire in order to delay the visit. They'll provide them with the option of entering the bathroom only to have them destroy their brassiere by having them take the metal wiring out and or depart from the prison complex and spend time and money to drive to the nearest outlet to purchase a non-metal wireless brassiere, causing an unnecessary delay of time and expenses overall." On September 5, 2014, Mark Shedden from the Pennsylvania Prison Society arrived at SCI Frackville as an official visitor at or about 8:50 a.m. At or about 10:35 a.m., I was paged to report to my pre-scheduled official visitor to meet with Mark Shedden. A sergeant directed me to report to the property room for them to inspect my legal materials prior to entering my official visit. I sat idly for 45 minutes before an officer proceeded to inspect my legal work. Upon my arrival to visiting search, another officer grabbed my legal work and inspected all of it again. As Mark Shedden proceeded to enter the visiting room and informed me, he was highly disappointed with the way our visit was handled by the lobby officers at SCI Frackville, having to wait for 2.5 hours without any explanation for the extreme tardiness. Lieutenant Reese's response to my grievance, number 527603, to what occurred during our visit is somewhat troublesome and remains quite peculiar, to say the least. On October 7, 2014, Lieutenant Reeves stated, in response to your grievance, dated 9-10-14, all relevant parties were interviewed concerning your grievance. I can assure you that the delay in your visit was not premeditated nor deliberate action. There were three consecutive, quote-unquote, extraordinary occurrences that require staff response on the day of your visit. These events were not in our control, causing an uncommon delay in your visit. Again, I assure you that staff did not intentionally delay your visit, and further such visits should not encounter the same circumstances. The irony in all of this is that Lieutenant Reese openly admitted SCI Frackville staff lost complete control of institution's function, which affected the visitor's lobby area, allegedly causing an uncommon delay in our visit. Upon entering the visiting room, Mark and I noticed many prisoners enjoying their visits without incident. This raises certain questions about why our visit was specifically treated indifferently if, in fact, Frackville's security department were experiencing events that went far beyond their complete control. However, many visitors were processed without these events affecting the process of their visit. Just our visit was held in abeyance for 2.5 hours. Lieutenant Reese's baseless and unfounded explanations leads one to clearly see the faulty facts contradicting the circumstances that took place on the day of our official visit. The rationale is anemic and specious at best and warrants further investigation into this incident affecting our visit, unnecessarily causing a 2.5 hour delay. Note that the natural explanation to all that has occurred with our visit is simply answered. This is Frackville, an anonymous kingdom all to its own. Brandon Miller, JG5529, states, upon being blackballed for this transfer as the pick of the litter from SCI Mahanoy to SCI Frackville, I've been subjected to get on top of the bunk every waking day and night by, first, stepping on the toilet, 2, the slippery sink, 3, to the top of the unsteady cabinet, 4, and with a leap of faith, jump onto the top bunk, which is literally an accident waiting to happen. The top bunks are without ladders and safety rails to get up and down safely from. Superintendent Brenda L. Tritt stated, the top bunks were never constructed with ladders and safety rails when SCI Frackville was built in 1987. It is unsettling and mentally frustrating having to just think about getting up and down from the top bunk with impending thoughts of one day becoming the next victim to an unforeseen, terrible, and tragic accident every day and night. An anonymous female veteran officer inquired about where we came from. I responded from SCI Mahanoy with a Wicked Witch grimace, smirked, and said, you guys got the messy side of the tampon, nice and fresh. Welcome to Frackville, boys. Till this day, I haven't been able to figure out why I was transferred from Mahanoy to Frackville. Frackville has commenced engaging in stripping Z-codes from prisoners who are being housed in single cells due to their history of mental health issues by forcing them to accept cellmates with predictably violent consequences and vice versa. One such prisoner by the name of Carlos Iglesias has vehemently rejected the idea and indicated if the DOC happens to place anyone inmate inside my cell, he would be confronted with the potential reality of committing murder and or literally sodomizing the individual inmate the DOC decides to set up for this death trap. Carlos readily admits, this is a sad and stark reality for the unsuspecting and unwitting victim. Carlos has a checkered mental health history and refuses to cohabit with any prisoner. He promises to take any and all measures to defend his position. If the DOC enforces to impose him with the idea alone, there will be detrimental consequences for both the DOC and the alleged victim. Obviously, this transfer has the insidious and nefarious hallmarks of retaliation encoded in it. Roger Buell, AM7936, is a lifer and has been incarcerated in PA for over 30 years. At various facilities, including security level 4 and 5 facilities, while each facility has its own particular character, SCI Frackville does stand apart in both reputation and negative attitude. Indeed, most problems here are rooted in the guards' culture of arrogance towards all prisoners generally and rule, procedure, or right that tends to protect or favor prisoners. This culture encompasses disdain and blatant disregard for principles of fair and humane treatment, open disrespect towards prisoners, and arbitrary abuses of authority and petty harassment are routine practice. Larger issues contributes to the SCI Frackville misery quotient. prisoners' access to health care has been a serious problem in the state system at large. Another issue arises from food service. Budget cuts have already reduced prisoners' meal portions and selections, and the state system's summer menu was subjected to even further cuts. The guards, however, still get unlimited meals, including specialty food items, all at state expenses, of course. The kitchen reserves freezer number 6 strictly for staff members, which contains a treasure trove of specialty food items separate from the prisoner items. SCI Frackville's practice of confining prisoners to their cells for a majority of the day, fostering feelings of frustration and depression. These problems all add up to a stressful, depressing experience for any prisoner, particularly those who were transferred here without notice or legitimate penological reason in the absence of any misconduct. This administration at SCI Frackville has undergone some changes in the last 2 years. A new superintendent, Ms. Brenda L. Tritt, was posted here in 2013, and she has made some major personnel changes which resulted in marginal improvements. The administration recently included replacements as a deputy superintendent position, grievance coordinator position, and the security department position. Superintendent Tritt is an able administrator, and she has at times accorded fair treatment towards prisoners. This is not to state that she is pro-prisoner, which she is not, but rather she's not overly focused on the unjustified grind-up of prisoners. Unfortunately, Superintendent Tritt is dealing with a strong, entrenched negative culture decades in the making, and she probably gets more resistance as a female administrator in a male-dominated environment. These factors appear to preclude any major changes to improve our conditions or rectify the problems that impacts those prisoners transferred here to this anonymous fiefdom.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.